from Hamilton to Frozen to Greece. People breaking into song in the middle of a dramatic scene is something so common now that we don't realize how revolutionary it was in the last century. Director of Flying Carpet Theater and musical maven, Adam Copeland, joins us again for our second in a series about the Great American Songbook. Adam, welcome back to City Lights.
I'm so glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. Now, you want to begin with the musical Showboat. Why was it a turning point in American musical theater?
I think it's important, before we even get into Showboat, to talk about what the culture of music and musical theater was before Showboat showed up on the scene in the late 20s. It was a culture of reviews. Vaudeville houses across the country would have a lineup of performers, and they would sing songs or do comedy bits. And on Broadway, which had hundreds of theaters, much more than it does now, it was the way people got entertainment. They would have an evening programmed, but you wouldn't see a play. You might see a little skit that led into a song, and then they would clear the stage, and there would be another little skit that would lead into a song. There were increasingly songs that were part of dramatic stories. Largely, those stories were lightly comic. They were romances, mostly for people who had some money. So they might be an upper class couple going off to Paris and having some adventure there. And then what might happen is there would be a song that all of a sudden was sort of wedged into their romance that kind of had nothing to do with their budding romance. It might be a song about flowers or about France, but it wouldn't in any way really be related to the dramatic action.
So with Showboat, the emphasis moved to story.
So in Showboat, we had Roger. Hammerstein, Oscar Hammerstein II, collaborated with a very important composer named Jerome Kern, and they put together a story about a community of entertainers on a showboat.
Ah.
So first of all, you have a reason to have people singing. They're already a group of entertainers. It almost made sense. You had this dazzling set of a showboat, and the story was a little bit more daring than people were used to. It dealt with an interracial relationship. It dealt with a gambler who ultimately ended up having to leave his wife because of his addiction. It had to do with failure in a lot of ways. And so people used to these kind of light romances, a woman descending into alcoholism because her husband is a ne'er-do-well or leaves her. These were not themes for the musical comedies of the 20s.
Nor was getting a closer look at racism.
Totally agree.
I mean, we think of musical as musical comedy as early as 1927 with Showboat. This was a musical, but it wasn't a comedy.
Not a comedy. And the other big, big innovation here is that they were hoping for the music, the plot, and the lyrics to all push the story forward. They didn't want to stop the story. The song was going to come at a place in the plot where it made sense to come.
So let's hear an example of how that's done. Let's listen to Barbara Cook and Stephen Douglas singing Make Believe.
Who cares if my boat goes upstream, or if the gale bids me go with the river's flow? I drift along with my fancy. Sometimes I thank my lucky stars my heart is free. And other times I wonder where's the mate for me. Thank you. only make believe I love you. Only make believe that you love me. Others find peace of mind in pretending. Couldn't you, couldn't I, couldn't we make believe our lips are blending in a phantom kiss? Or two or three, might as well make believe I love you. For to tell the truth, I do. Your pardon I pray, 'twas too much to say.
Barbara Cook eventually comes in the interest of time. Ah, there she is. Let's hear her a little more.
You do not offend in playing a lover's part. The game of just supposing.
Okay, Adam. What was extraordinary here?
Usually, up to this point, flirting lovers wouldn't necessarily talk exactly about their situation or what was happening right there on stage. This was as if somebody had written a romantic scene where a couple, the gambler in this scene, the male singer, is kind of pitching that he should be the romantic partner of this teenager. And she says, oh, I don't think I could. He said, well, let's make believe. And she wants to be an actress. So by pitching this idea of let's make believe, it's kind of a way of wooing her. And it's wooing her through a little bit of subtext and through some figurative language. And again, it was really like somebody had written a play where the character might have said that, and then they turned it into this poetic song.
Gorgeous.
And that really wasn't that common at the time.
Wow. Well, the southern backdrop of Showboat allowed for racism to be addressed within the musical context, as we touched upon a moment ago. The role of Joe was written for the great Paul Robeson. He appeared in the show on stage in London in 1928, and in the Broadway revival in 1932. Dissertations could be written about Paul Robeson singing Old Man River. There probably have been. What did he achieve with performing that song?
So the song itself is part of what was revolutionary about Showboat is that there were a range of American styles put into this musical. And Kern, who had a European songwriting training, he had gone off to Germany and London to learn his craft, still was able to very much absorb the sounds of the South into his songwriting. So he writes this song that is based on a spiritual form. There aren't that many people who have a bass like Paul Robeson.
Oh, that's understating it.
Yeah, and so to be able to find somebody just technically who could pull this off, that's already a hurdle. To find somebody who could pull it off with the soul and the subtext and the star power that Robeson had, I mean, you're talking one in a million.
Let's listen to this recording, one of several Paul Robeson made of Old Man River.
Darkies all work on the Mississippi, darkies all work while the white folks play, pulling them boats from the dawn to sunset, getting no rest till the judgment day.
Don't look up and don't look down, the long dust play, the white folks round, then you'll be by your head.
Let me go away from the Mississippi, let me go away from the white man boss.
show me that stream called the River Jordan. That's the old stream that I long to cross.
Get out your handkerchiefs.
There's a bunch of Paul Robeson stories, obviously, around this song. He performed it for the rest of his career, and across his career, he started changing and tinkering with the lyrics as he performed it in concert. The show was meant and designed to be addressing racism and critical of racism.
Yeah, this is not a happy slave.
No, no. And to have somebody complaining or throwing a critical eye on their lot was very unusual in the context of the 20s. And to not have a range of now, let's put it into context. We look at Showboat now, and to some degree, there is some discomfort at the depiction of African-American folks, without question. But at the time, relative to the outrageous stereotyping that was going on, this character, this song, represented a marked shift. Even so, Paul Robeson liked to tinker with the lyrics so that I think, as originally written, the tone is a little bit more one of resignation. In his tinkering as he went through, and by the time he was done, it was more empowered, I would say.
And defiant.
Defiant.
I mean, he performed it in Russia. It was a statement on inequality, a plea for justice, righteous indignation. I mean, I'm tired of living and scared of dying. It's stunning.
Another unusual fact about the way this song and the musical came into being: Robeson shows up. He's Princeton educated. He's very sophisticated. These songs are written by Hammerstein in a black dialect of the day, which he was uncomfortable with, and according to, you know, maybe this is apocryphal, but according to the stories around it, a lyric was written as, taters are in the lyric. And he said, taters? What are taters? And I said, potatoes. He's like, well, why are you calling them taters? And the grammar should be this way. And they had a little back and forth about how it should be sung.
If you're just joining us, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzis, and my guest today is director Adam Copeland. Adam, you agree with the many scholars who believe that Oklahoma finished the integration of lyric, book, story, and music that Showboat began. How does Oklahoma go beyond Showboat?
The integration, I think. I know it's kind of a nerdy word, but while the idea of putting a musical story together that where the songs further the plot really was started in Showboat, the idea that partially you learn a little bit about the story through the music, the actual score. Partially you learn a little bit about it through the lyrics. Partially you learn a little bit about what was going on in the distance between what the music is telling you and what the lyrics are telling you. Partially you learn about it from the book. And then here's another big thing that Oklahoma did. You learn about it through the choreography. That Oklahoma made room for choreography to be a major expression of how the musical tells you the story. So
yeah.
They put all of these elements together in a way that had never really been done before. They didn't open with a brassy production number. They didn't nail you over the head with a huge set that said, look, there was certainly some spectacle, but it all existed a little bit differently than what had come before.
Is it fair to say that the songs for Oklahoma basically don't lend themselves well to performance outside of the context of the show?
They're certainly done, and they're beautiful, but I agree, Lois. I think that in an era where you could write music that really was all about the song, that frees up a songwriter to only worry about what's going to communicate across 3 minutes. Now, just to take a step back, Showboat had been written, the music had been written by Jerome Kern. At this point, Oscar Hammerstein, same book and lyric writer, is collaborating with Richard Rodgers. And Richard Rodgers writes this absolutely gorgeous score that's riffing on a lot of American motifs, folk music, Western music. What Hammerstein is giving him, though, are lyrics that are designed to either push the plot forward or reveal character or both. And when that is the sort of mandate of the book writer, it isn't about how much are you going to communicate in a 3-minute song about one theme. It's really about how that song is going to work in the context of a 2 or 2.5 hour musical. And so if you think about writing a song, Surrey with a Fringe on top, I mean, it's like, who would use that image?
Going to be in Liza's Vegas show.
No, it really has to work inside a story where that image makes sense. So I think that, and there's many examples like that in Oklahoma and every musical that came after.
I want to hear a little of the Surrey with a Fringe on top in Hugh Jackman's version.
When I take you out tonight with me, honey, here's the way it's gonna be. You will sit behind a team of snow-white horses in the slickest gig you ever see.
Lambs.
Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out in the Surrey. When I take you out in the Surrey with a fringe on top. Watch that fringe and see how it flutters. I drive them high-stepping strutters. Nosy pokes will peek through the shutters and their eyes will pop. The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown, the dashboard's genuine leather. With eyes and glass curtains you can roll right down in case there's a change in the weather. Two broad side lights winking and blinking. Ain't no finer rig I'm a-thinking. Your rig, if you're thinking that I'd get a swap for that shiny little Surrey with a fringe on the top.
Okay, I guess we wouldn't hear that in, you know, a Carnegie Hall concert.
At this point, we might. It's so popular and wonderful, but you can imagine at the time it was
sure.
Like, wow, what an unusual image.
Yeah, and how do Aussies, you know, master that? What is it? Why can everybody else speak American better than we
well,
do?
Well, that guy is so talented. He seems to be able to do a lot. One of the things that the show really didn't have compared to a lot of the things of the time were kind of opening up with a kick line of fabulous, slightly scantily clad girls, huge sets kind of swinging or coming in and going out. And the when it opened in New Haven, as a lot of shows did at that time, most people thought its prospects were totally grim. The journalist Walter Winchell had some people at the show, and somebody wrote him to say, No girls, no legs, no jokes, no chance.
Boy, was he wrong.
Right.
Well, as far as the legs were put to use, Agnes DeMille's choreography also was extraordinary for Broadway musical. What did she add that distinguished Oklahoma from other shows?
Again, this has to, everything that we're talking about has to do with elements forwarding a story. So in what had come before, dance might be eye-catching, it might be fun, but it wasn't thought of as a tool that you could use to help further the plot, deepen the understanding of the characters. She creates these dances that give a window into what the inner life of the characters are. And they're risky. In some cases, they're 12 minutes long. And she lets people see what Laurie's inner struggle is through dance. Now, that just hadn't been done before. It was really revolutionary. And in fact, even the word choreographer, this kind of this level of seriousness, really starts getting used from the 40s on. Before, people were using dance director, captain. Yeah, this marks this shift in kind of the seriousness. And she had an acting background. And part of, I think, what made her have special insight into how choreography could really be an important tool was that she wanted to let the dance bring character out.
Well, I have a factoid. I don't want to call it trivia because it's not trivial, but it does have local significance. Her son is a history professor at Emory.
What? No way.
And full disclosure, a very close friend, his wife. So there's a nice Emory connection Agnes DeMille, and they put on Oklahoma a few years ago, Theater Emory.
How cool.
Okay.
And her uncle, evidently, was Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah, I think he wasn't so helpful to her.
That makes sense.
I think if I remember the story, when she asked for help, he told her to sell a strand of pearls, if the story goes. Okay, let's hear some more music from Oklahoma. We want to give the ladies a chance.
Yes.
And there's something slightly risque with I Can't Say No. Let's hear it.
It ain't so much a question of not knowing what to do. I knowed what's right and wrong since I've been 10. I heard a lot of stories and I reckon they're true about how girls are put upon by men. I know I mustn't fall into the pit, but when I'm with a feller, I forget. I'm just a girl who can't say no. I'm in a terrible fix. I always say, come on, let's go, just when I ought to say nix. When a person tries to kiss a girl, I know she ought to give his face a smack. But as soon as someone kisses me, I somehow sort of want to kiss him back. I'm just a fool when lights are low. I can't be prissy and quaint. I ain't the type that can faint. How can I be what I ain't? I can't say no. What you gonna do when a fella gets flirty and starts?
Okay, so consider the year. What was Oklahoma 1946?
Early, I think 42, 43. We're still in the middle of the war.
Okay. Yeah. Well, a girl who couldn't say no, you know. But she says, I can't say no. And she just loves the flattery and just wants to give him a little kiss. So
again, remember that we have a person revealing elements of their character. They're talking to other people. She's setting up her dramatic problem, which gets played out through the rest of the piece. So this wasn't meant to be just a standalone song about a girl who can't say no. It was meant to help us understand what her situation was.
Ah, yes. Oh, Adam, you have helped us through this second edition in our series of the Great American Songbook so beautifully. Thank you, and we look forward to your return.
Oh, I love being here. Thank you, thank you.
Director Adam Copeland is the artistic director of Flying Carpet Theater. He is our homegrown Broadway maven based here in Atlanta. Adam, thank you again.